witness that it's all accurate. I have three recommendations.
Lay them out.
Yes, sir. First, I recommend we move to DEFCON 3 and stand by for a possible move to DEFCON 2. This will put all U.S. conventional and strategic nuclear forces on high alert. If nuclear war becomes imminent, we may have to move to DEFCON 1 for the first time in history. Second, you should direct the Secretary of State to call an emergency video conference of the North Atlantic Council to explain to NATO as much as we can of the latest intel and the imminence of a Russian invasion. Make it clear to our allies that any attack by Russia on the Baltic states or any other NATO member will trigger Article 5. And third, Mr. President, I recommend we get you on the hotline to talk with President Luganov directly and see if you can't head this thing off before the missiles start flying.
79. Everything he'd learned to protect our president, he was now using to take out theirs. Given that he couldn't say a word to Morris or draw on any of her assets or expertise, Marcus rated the chances of success of assassinating Luganov at no more than 1 in 5, if that. Still, that wasn't his main focus just at the moment. The plan for getting Alec out was. This was one topic he could discuss with Morris, but it wasn't going well. They'd gotten the go-ahead from Washington, only to learn one of the pilots they needed to fly them out was sick in bed with a 104-degree fever. The co-pilot was already doing all the pre-flight checks, but the flight plan hadn't been approved. And now, a massive winter storm that no one had seen coming was moving in. At least the weapons Marcus had asked for had come in. He had in his possession a Wool, a silent Russian pistol, and the Vinterez sniper rifle favored by Soviet special forces. Marcus pulled off the main highway. He parked the white Volga Gaz-21 in the shadows behind a self-service Lukoil gas station that was open but deserted. Grabbing his sat phone, weapons, and keys, he locked the beat-up old sedan and jumped into the brand-new Mercedes SUV that Jenny Morris was driving right behind him. Several hours from now, they would leave the Mercedes here and proceed to the airport in the Volga. Hopefully, throwing off anyone who might observe them driving to or from their next destination. As they drove the 6 miles to Rublyovka, home of Moscow's wealthiest and most powerful families, Marcus briefly considered telling Morris who his source really was, how they had met, and that they were actually going to meet him at his parents' house. The moment she saw him, after all, she would know exactly who he was. Still, he'd made a promise to the man, and he wasn't about to break it. If Alec were killed in the house or taken down while trying to kill the president, Marcus might never need to tell her. If Alec actually lived through the next several hours and made it to the plane, he could give them a proper introduction then. The house should be deserted, Marcus knew. Alec had assured him that his parents had left the country hours earlier and should be halfway across the continent by now. The Kruskin estate was nearly a kilometer away from the nearest neighbor. What's more, Alec's childhood home was surrounded on 3 sides by dense woods, long manicured lawns, and even a pond in the backyard with a small island in its center. Alec had given Marcus all the passcodes they would need to enter both the main gates to the community and the gates to his parents' property, and to disarm the security system. And they had nearly a 2-hour head start to get everything ready. Neither Marcus nor Jenny Morris was prepared for the spectacular size of the secluded mansion, or for the fantastic wealth Alec's family had built up in the post-Soviet years. Marcus had understood they were successful, but not that Alec's father was an actual oligarch. Yet, as they pulled through the iron gates along the half-moon drive up to the front door, they found themselves gaping at a sprawling 40-room Scottish-style baronial castle with steeped gables, ornate conical turrets, and even four black witch's hat roofs, one in each corner. Marcus put on his gloves, pulled a black balaclava over his face, and donned night vision goggles as they approached. Morris did the same. The plan called for her to drop Marcus off in front of the huge house, then speed off down a service road, past the five-car garage and several stone outbuildings, before pulling the Mercedes deep into the forest, cutting the lights, and parking a half-click from the house to begin setting up her equipment. Marcus disarmed the security system and entered the house cautiously. There were no signs of life, no sounds but the ticking of an antique grandfather clock in the opulent vestibule, replete with Italian marble floors and 17th-century French artwork. The silenced pistol drawn, and the disassembled sniper rifle slung over his back. He stealthily moved from room to room, confirming that no one was inside, starting with the top floor and working his way down. Given the building's length and breadth, it took longer than Marcus had planned. On the top floor, he found 12 bedrooms, including a master bedroom larger than any single room at the White House. Each bedroom had its own bathroom. There was a library and a study for Mr. Kroskin and another for his wife, as well as a workout room. On the main level, Marcus found a private movie theater with both a state-of-the-art digital projection system and a 35mm film projector. There was an indoor pool that could open to an outdoor pool overlooking the pond. A large screened porch adjoined a glassed-in breakfast room, along with enormous living and dining rooms, a piano room, and a kitchen large enough to feed the Red Army. In the basement, Marcus found three more guest rooms, a jacuzzi room and sauna, a billiard room with a full bar, and laundry facilities. He also found the panic room Alec had told him about. He entered the code he'd been given and stepped inside. 14 feet by 14 feet, with reinforced steel walls, ceiling, and floor. It was really more of a bomb shelter than a panic room. At one end was an independent oxygen system, several large drums of potable water, a chemical toilet, a small round table with four wooden chairs, and a television and shortwave radio. Bunk beds lined the side walls. At the near end of the room was a tiny kitchenette, a pantry with canned goods, and shelves lined with battery-operated lamps and flashlights. The room systems operated from an independent power source that should remain up and running even if power went out in the rest of the house. Marcus exited the safe room and re-entered the code, closing the vault's steel door behind him. Then he found the utility closet Alec had directed him to, the one containing two large water heaters, the HVAC system, the house's internet routers, and an assortment of other panels controlling various systems within the house and throughout the grounds. He focused on the circuit box that regulated power coming in from the main electrical grid. Underneath it, he magnetically attached a thin silver cylinder that could easily be mistaken for part of the original system if it wasn't studied carefully. Inside the cylinder were a remote detonator and enough plastic explosives to knock out power to the whole house. His initial preparations complete, Marcus raced back upstairs, reactivated the master alarm system, and then, in the 60 seconds he had before the motion sensors kicked in, bounded up to the second floor and found the door leading to the attic. It was, as he'd been told, locked. But using the key he'd found in the drawer of the nightstand on the right side of the master bedroom, exactly where Alec had said it would be, he quickly unlocked the door to the attic, then replaced the key in the drawer, headed back to the attic stairway, and closed and locked the door behind him. Marcus activated his night vision goggles as he made his way into the unheated, and thus chilly, top floor storage area, and found himself next to a small window that looked out toward the private access road leading to the property. The window wasn't designed to be opened. He was tempted to cut out one or two of the glass panes to prepare for what was coming next, but he decided against it. The window was, for now, the only thing keeping out the rain and the wind, if not the cold. Instead, he removed and unzipped his backpack, pulled out the pieces of the sniper rifle, reassembled them, and settled in for the wait, though it wouldn't be long now. "Razor to keyhole, over," he said, lowering the volume on his earpiece slightly and adjusting the whisper microphone pressed against his right cheek.
"Keyhole to razor, copy. Reading you 5x5, over,"
Morris replied. "Status check."
"Good to go. And you? Over."
"Locked and loaded," said Marcus, "and ready for showtime." 80. Alec padded out into the living room in his silk pajamas. He intended to inform his detail that he couldn't sleep and order them to take him to his parents' house. But he was stunned to see so many additional agents.
"What's the meaning of this?" he demanded. "Who are all these people?"
The supervisor apologized for the surprise. He said the detail had been beefed up on direct orders from the president. Normally, he would have informed Alec immediately, but given all the stresses on him, he had thought it best to let him get his sleep. As furious as he was terrified, Alec stormed back into his bedroom and slammed the door, only to realize that he'd been so stunned by the presence of so many additional FSB agents that he hadn't said anything about going to Rublyovka. He picked up the phone by his bed and called the supervisor. Next, he changed into blue jeans and a fisherman knit sweater, and threw a change of clothes and a freshly pressed business suit and some toiletries in an overnight bag. Then he grabbed the satellite phone and took it into the bathroom. Marcus felt the sat phone buzzing in his pocket.
"What?" he whispered.
"We have a problem," Alec said.
"Tell me."
"The president boosted my detail to 12 agents."
"Why?"
"I have no idea."
"Has something happened?"
"I don't know."
"Has there been a threat made against you? Or do you think he suspects something?"
"I told you I don't know,"
Alec replied.
"I just wanted you to be prepared."
With that, he hung up the phone. Marcus closed his eyes. The calculus had changed. Now he knew he had to tell Morris whose house they were at and how high the stakes really were. How else was he going to explain all the extra company they were about to receive and all the firepower they were bringing with them? He just prayed she wouldn't call the whole mission off.
"Razor to keyhole," he said. "I have new information for you."
McDermott huddled with Clark in the Oval.
"Two things, Mr. President," he said, as he stood beside the resolute desk.
"Make it quick."
"Yes, sir. First, we're reaching out to the Kremlin to set up a hotline call for you and President Luganov. But we have to be realistic. It's the middle of the night in Moscow. I'd recommend we place the call at, say, 8 a.m. their time. That would be 1 a.m. here, if that's all right."
"That's fine. Just make sure it happens."
"Absolutely, sir. The second thing is about the extraction of the Raven."
"What about it?"
"Well, sir, if our people can actually get him safely out of Russia, we need to make a decision about where to bring him."
"Here to the States, of course. Why?"
"We're talking about a very senior Russian official, essentially defecting at a very delicate moment in U.S.-Russia relations,"
McDermott noted.
"And you don't think it's wise to bring him to the States?"
"It may be prudent not even to acknowledge that we have him, sir."
"Where else would you take him?"
"We're thinking Egypt, sir. We've set up a special facility outside Alexandria, top secret, completely off the radar, but safe."
"And deniable?"
"Yes, sir."
"What does Director Stevens say?"
"He agrees."
"Then Egypt it is."
"Keyhole to razor, they're coming," Morris said.
It was pouring again, a bitter, biting rain that was soon going to shift into snow. It was early, but it wasn't completely unheard of for the Moscow metropolitan area to get its first snow in early fall. Morris was shivering from waiting out in the elements for an hour and a half. But there was no point griping about it, or even thinking about it. Through her high-powered night-vision binoculars, she could see two black SUVs coming down the highway. They were less than 2 miles out. Setting down the binoculars, Morris picked up the weapon at her side, attached its silencer, and peered through the night-vision scope. Moments later, the entourage entered the gated community and pulled up in front of the estate. It was 4:01. The Raven, who she now knew was none other than Alec Kroskin and his newly enlarged security team, were right on time. Morris glanced at the Mercedes positioned about 30 yards to her right. She camouflaged it with branches and foliage. Now she worried the rains and wind might wash away enough of it to make the SUV visible if Kroskin's security detail did a thorough search of the woods. She felt in the darkness for her pistol and clicked off the safety. She took a long look to her right and to her left, then behind her. She didn't want anyone to catch her off guard. Satisfied she had the woods to herself, at least for the moment, she fought to slow and steady her breathing. She'd done 2 tours in Iraq with Army intelligence. She'd helped hunt down dozens of high-value targets before being recruited by the agency and sent to language school to add Russian to her Arabic and Farsi. She'd done all sorts of crazy things for her government. But she'd never lain on her stomach in a Russian forest in the freezing rain, aiming a loaded weapon at a team of highly trained Russian FSB officers and Spetsnaz commandos. She was seriously doubting herself for ever letting Marcus Riker design this plan and run this operation. She didn't care if he was the only link to the Raven. He wasn't the CIA's top dog in Russia. He wasn't responsible for managing more than 120 officers and some 3 dozen Russian agents they'd recruited throughout the military, Duma, and executive branch. Yet somehow, she'd let him dictate exactly what was going to happen and how. She hadn't even put up a fight. He spoke with a humility and yet an air of authority unlike any other civilian she'd come across. And given the amount of time they'd had, his plan was probably the best anyone could come up with. But it was risky. It was bad enough when they had to contend with 4 bodyguards. But 12? If this went badly, it was going to go very badly. Marcus heard the vehicles pull up out front. He turned his night vision goggles back on and glanced out the small attic window. He could see 2 large bodyguards emerging from the lead SUV. They were dressed in suits and raincoats and held submachine guns at the ready. One moved cautiously through the darkness around to the backyard. The other moved toward the front door. The rest of the detail remained dry and warm in their SUVs, which now turned around and parked facing the main gate and the road beyond it. They had made their first mistake, Marcus realized. With 12 men on the team, at least 8 of them should have jumped out to set up a secure perimeter and thoroughly search the house, regardless of the weather, leaving behind only the 2 drivers keeping their engines running and 2 body men staying close to their principal, Alec Stefanovich Kroskin.
"Keyhole to razor,"
Jenny Morris whispered in his headset.
"What?"
Marcus asked, annoyed by the sudden break of radio silence.
"Did you reset the alarm system? Over."
"Affirmative."
"Hold your position and wait for my command."
In theory, they were in an ideal tactical position. Morris had suggested that they could cut down the Russian security force with breathtaking speed, assuming that Marcus wasn't found by the lone agent sweeping the house. Once the all-clear signal was radioed back to the head of the detail, the agents would prepare to whisk Alec inside. As soon as the doors of both SUVs opened and all the agents, aside from the drivers, began to exit, it would be like shooting fish in a barrel. Marcus had the high ground from a fixed yet hidden position. He could open fire and likely take out 4 or 5 of the Russians before they even realized where the rounds were coming from. Simultaneously, he could give the order to Morris to begin firing from the woods at the agents emerging from the other side of the vehicles. If she was as proficient a marksman as she claimed, she could likely take out all or most of the Russians on her side in a matter of seconds. But the windows of both SUVs were tinted. That meant neither Marcus nor Jenny knew which vehicle their subject was in, and they couldn't afford the possibility of Alec being hit in the crossfire. It wasn't just the thumb drive Marcus needed. He needed Alec alive to execute the next phase of the plan. 81. Don't die and don't get arrested. His mother's words rang in his ears as Marcus heard the front door open. He heard someone enter the code to disarm the security system. It seemed to take forever, but eventually he heard someone coming up the stairs from the first floor to the second. This was it. There was no turning back now. He gripped the Russian-made pistol as he listened to doors opening and closing. Marcus could visualize every step the agent was taking. He'd cleared homes like this 1,000 times, and every time had forced himself to resist the temptation to believe everything was fine and the location was safe. Marcus knew exactly what this agent was thinking. Alec had announced the decision to come to his parents' home less than an hour before. He'd made the decision in the middle of the night. The agent would certainly have been told that the Kroskins had left the country earlier in the evening and would not be home. They had no servants or staff, no pets, nobody house-sitting, only a housekeeping crew that came on Monday mornings. Thus, the agent believed no one could possibly have known that Alec was going to be there that night. This, more than the rotten weather, which, after all, was a staple of a Russian bodyguard's existence, was the single most important reason the entire detail wasn't on highest alert. They simply could not foresee a realistic, immediate threat. Still, Marcus knew the agent was a professional. He would at least be looking for hidden weapons, explosives, listening devices, surveillance cameras, or anything that seemed odd or out of place. The door handle to the attic rattled. The agent was checking to make sure it was locked. But rather than move on, as Marcus had fully hoped and expected he would, the agent slipped a key into the lock. Marcus froze as he heard the door open. He instinctively held his breath as a beam from the agent's flashlight shone up the stairs and swept from side to side, stopping finally on the small window. Marcus, hidden in a crawl space around the corner from the stairwell, was not immediately visible. But he was now grateful he hadn't removed any of the glass panes. That would have been a dead giveaway. Marcus silently prayed the agent would be satisfied with a quick glance up the stairs and go on to finish his check of the rest of the house. But suddenly, he heard the steps creaking. This guy was doing his job. He was doing it more thoroughly than Marcus had anticipated, and this radically changed the calculus. Marcus quietly turned off his night vision goggles. He steadied the pistol in one hand. In his other, he held the remote switch to the explosive charge in the basement. But he couldn't take out the power now. It would destroy his most important advantage, the element of surprise. Marcus watched as the man's shadow came up the stairs, cast by the light from the second-floor hallway. He was moving slowly, too slowly, as if he suspected something. But how could he? Marcus had been careful to leave no trace of his presence. His backpack was at his feet, deep inside the crawlspace. The sniper rifle was at his side. He hadn't left a flashlight or anything else on the stairs or at the base of the window. What was wrong?
Why was the man moving so slowly? Now, why had he stopped?
Then Marcus saw what the agent saw. On the wall below the small window were smudges of dust. Marcus realized he must have made them when he was trying to maneuver in the cramped quarters. The man's flashlight was fixated on them. Surely he was evaluating whether they were fresh or had been left there by the owners or a workman or even Alec in the past. Again, he began making his way up the stairs. Time seemed to stand still. Marcus knew he couldn't shoot the man. To do so could blow his cover. Alec was not yet out of the vehicle and in the house. If Marcus fired at this man and his whisper mic was on, he could alert a dozen Russian agents who could storm the house or speed off with Alec and the computer files. But if the agent found Marcus, he would likely shoot first and ask questions later. Either way, the plan was blown. Marcus had to make a decision. So he pulled the trigger 4 times in less than a second, firing blind through the crawlspace wall. All 4 bullets pierced the drywall. 3 hit their mark. The Russian collapsed and slid down the stairs. Marcus bolted from the crawlspace. He pivoted around the corner and saw the agent sprawled on the floor. It was possible he was already dead, but there was no margin for error. He fired 2 more shots, 1 into the man's heart, the other into his head. He knew he wasn't wrong about all the consequences that could unfold from his decision to take this guy out. But in the end, the calculation had come down to 1 decision. Kill or be killed. 82. Marcus immediately discharged the partially empty magazine from his pistol. He pulled another mag from his belt and locked it in place. Given the Russian weapon's built-in silencer, no one outside the house could possibly have heard the shots. A quick peek out the window showed no movement, suggesting no one had heard the body fall down the stairs or heard the man's submachine gun drop to the floor. "Razor to keyhole, target down," he said. "Stand by to engage. Over." "What target?" came the stunned reply, devoid of all radio protocol. "What are you talking about? You shot someone already?"
"Wait one," Marcus replied, as he shoved the pistol into his holster, grabbed the VSS rifle, and flicked a switch, changing it from single-shot sniper mode to full-on automatic. He inched halfway down the stairs, listening intently for any sounds of movement below. Hearing none, he double-checked the man's pulse and confirmed what he already knew, then scooped up the man's machine gun and stripped him of the rest of his weapons and ammo. There was blood all over the hallway carpet, but Marcus wasn't worried about that. One way or another, this would be over before any of the Russians made it to the second floor. Marcus removed the man's whisper mic, earpiece, and battery-powered wireless radio and put them on himself. Now he had 2, one connected to Morris, and this one connected to the entire Russian detail. This would have been ideal if he spoke Russian, but he did not. Jenny did, and he briefly considered ways of patching her into the Russian feed. For the moment, however, it did not matter. Only 1 thing did.
"Razor to keyhole. How do you say all clear in Russian? Over."
"What in the world?"
Morris shot back, a disturbing mix of confusion and fear in her voice. A mix that did not exactly bolster Marcus's confidence in her partnership at that moment.
"You heard me. All clear. Now. Over."
"Всё ясно. Over," she replied.
"Всё ясно?
Confirm. Over."
"Correct. Why?"
Marcus wasn't happy. He wasn't conducting a Socratic dialogue. He was in the middle of leading an operation with by far the biggest stakes of their careers. Morris should know better than to question him or engage in any extraneous conversation. There was no way he was going to walk her through what he was doing. He'd be happy to explain all in their after-action report, if they got that far, but certainly not now.
"Stand by,"
was all he said in response.
Marcus turned off the light in the second-floor hallway. He powered his night-vision goggles back up and moved to a bedroom with windows overlooking the front yard. Seeing no movement in the vehicles, he pressed the button to the Russian radio system and gave the all-clear signal exactly as Jenny had said it, and prayed it did the job. Then he waited. Would they buy it or bolt? A minute passed, then two, though it seemed like an hour. Finally, he heard the radio crackle to life. The head of the detail, presumably, was giving the order. It was in Russian, but its meaning was plain enough. Doors began to open. The Russians began to exit their vehicles. They'd bought it. The mission was still on. Marcus pinned himself against a wall on the second floor, next to the stairs, but out of position for anyone to see him if they glanced upward. He was amazed at how calm he felt. His breathing was steady. His pulse was barely above normal. The initial rush of adrenaline he'd felt minutes before had drained out of his system. His equilibrium had settled. He was back in control. The odds of complete success were long, to be sure. But at this point, he gambled that even if he died in a firefight inside the house, Morris could eliminate everyone outside and pick off the rest as they tried to rush Alec back to one of the SUVs. Whether she'd live long enough to talk to him, much less grab the thumb drive and get it uploaded to Langley, he had no idea. But he now put the odds at 50-50. And given the scenario, that really wasn't so bad. He asked his partner for a head count.
7 bogeys out of their vehicles heading for the front door, she said.
These, plus the agent he'd killed, and the one in the backyard, made 9. But that was odd. That left only the drivers, both of whom were certain to stay in their vehicles, keeping them running and ready for a quick escape if necessary. Was only one agent going to walk Alec inside? Sloppy, Marcus thought. Morris radioed again.
Keyhole to Razor. The headlights of both trucks just went dark. Both drivers are getting out, along with what looks like the head of the detail. They're putting a tight cordon around the subject and moving him toward the front door.
Marcus was surprised and went to the window to make sure Jenny was right. Sure enough, she was. If the drivers were shutting down their vehicles and getting out, it must mean the detail saw no immediate threat inside or outside the house. That was good news. It meant he and Jenny still retained the advantage. Still, there were now 10 highly trained Russian bodyguards in the house, and Marcus was going to have to take them on by himself.
Eyes on, over, he whispered,
making sure his math was correct.
Eyes on one. Repeat, eyes on one. The one they left to guard the front door,
Morris replied. Marcus didn't like the fact that they had no eyes on the agent stationed out back. But it couldn't be helped now. He listened for the last group of agents to enter the house with Alec. He could soon hear Alec talking in Russian, and though he couldn't understand a word the man was saying, it was obvious what the Raven was doing. He was putting the men at ease. They were laughing now. He could hear someone opening the refrigerator, kitchen cabinets opening and closing. A microwave started running. A moment later, he heard some glasses clinking, and the unmistakable sound of a wine cork popping. It seemed highly unlikely that the men assigned to Alec's protection were going to start drinking. Luganov would have their heads. But Marcus wouldn't be surprised at all if Alec started drinking. He was nervous. He would want to take the edge off. Marcus hoped Alec wouldn't drink too heavily. He would need his wits about him tonight. That was for certain.
83. The thunder had died off. The lightning had stopped. A quick glance out the window proved the storm was not subsiding. But with the temperatures dropping, the rain had turned to a mixture of sleet and snow, and it was falling hard.
Marcus felt bad for his compadre. Jenny had been out in the elements for nearly 2 hours, and she had to be freezing. He liked this woman, professionally, anyway. He didn't really know her, of course. They hadn't trained together. He hadn't observed her in action. He had no idea what she was capable of, or what her breaking point was. But he liked her moxie, if not her ability to maintain proper radio protocol.
"On my mark," he whispered. "Now."
Morris flexed her frozen fingers one last time and took a deep breath. Then she fired twice in rapid succession. The agent standing post on the front steps dropped to the walkway. She fired two more times just to make sure. She watched him closely, looking for any signs of life, either of his chest moving or the fog of the man's breath condensing in the frigid cold. Nothing. And the silencer had worked. She hadn't compromised her position at all.
"Target down," she said. "I repeat, target down. Over."
Marcus almost smiled under his balaclava. 2 down, 10 to go. He double-clicked his radio to signal he'd received her message. No longer could he risk speaking, even in a whisper. It was his turn now. He pushed the remote in his left hand. All the lights went out simultaneously as the power in the house went down. Marcus clicked on his night vision goggles and moved sure and fast. He spotted one agent standing post inside the front door and fired a quick burst with the Vinterez. Then realized to his horror he hadn't remembered to attach the silencer Jenny had given him. It was the first time he'd actually fired the Russian-built VSS, and it was far louder than he'd expected. The house erupted, with confused men shouting at each other in the dark. They were not prepared with night vision equipment. This gave Marcus another advantage. Turning right, he saw an agent standing just inside the vestibule and fired again, dropping him to the marble floor. Dashing down the stairs and pivoting around the corner, he tossed a stun grenade into the living room and shut his eyes. The explosion was deafening. The momentary burst of intense white light did its job, activating all the photoreceptors in his enemy's eyes and causing temporary disorientation and loss of hearing and balance. Marcus knew these men would recover quickly, given their training, so he had to make the most of what little time the M-84 had bought him. First, he unleashed a burst of fire at an agent stationed by the door to the garage, taking him out immediately. Next, he spun around and cut down another one by the back door. Running to the kitchen, Marcus expected to find at least one agent and Alec, but was caught off guard to find neither. He moved left into the dining room and saw an agent running right toward the piano room. The man opened fire, a scoot and shoot. Marcus dove for the floor and fired the rest of his magazine at the man, clipping him with his last round and sending him sprawling across the Persian rug. Marcus quickly ejected the spent mag and replaced it with a full one. Then spotted the man crawling across the floor, leaving a trail of blood in his wake. Marcus pulled the trigger, unleashing another short burst into the man until he stopped moving. 7 down, 5 to go. But where were the rest? And where was the Raven? So far Marcus had seen no sign of Alec. He hoped several agents had rushed him down to the panic room. That's what Alec had told him his detail was supposed to do. But what if they instead tried to rush him out of the house and into one of the bulletproof SUVs? Could Jenny take them out in time without hitting Alec? Slowly, methodically, he worked his way back to the archway between the piano room and the dining room, sweeping his weapon from one side to the other. His ears were still ringing from the explosion and the gunfire, making it all but impossible to hear his enemies moving across broken glass and splintered furniture, though they almost certainly were at the same disadvantage. The smell of fear in the room was rapidly overtaking the stench of the smoke from the flash bomb. Then Marcus saw two shadows moving in the distance. That's when the counteroffensive began. Gunfire erupted from his right, from the backyard through the bay windows. Marcus instantly hit the deck, but saw a grenade rolling past him. He scrambled to his feet and dove headfirst into the kitchen, just before the grenade exploded, destroying everything in its blast radius. Marcus slid along the hardwood floor, winding up behind the kitchen island as more gunfire erupted all around him. He raised the VSS rifle over his head and sprayed the room, hoping at least to buy himself a few seconds to reorient and retake the initiative. If he stayed where he was, he knew he was in very real danger of getting caught in a pincer movement. He had to make a break for it. Pulling the pin on a grenade of his own, he threw it the full length of the house. He heard it hit the far wall and roll into the vestibule, then heard men yelling furiously in Russian. The moment the grenade detonated, he sprinted forward. He didn't think he'd taken out anyone new. He just hoped he'd cleared himself a path. Marcus didn't know the floor plan as well as Alec's men, but he knew it well enough to navigate through the carnage to his target, the stairs leading to the basement. He tossed his last grenade down the stairs, then pivoted back and sprayed the vestibule with a full magazine. He bounded down the stairs, reloading as he moved, and came around the corner, gun blazing. The explosion had bought him just the time and distraction he needed. Through the night vision goggles, he spotted an agent about 10 yards to his right, standing guard in front of the panic room. The rounds hit their mark. But Marcus resisted the temptation to race to the end of the hallway, punch in the code, and see if his man was inside. Instead, he turned left, ducked inside the darkened billiard room, and made sure no one was in there. He waited. It didn't take long. No more than 10 seconds later, another grenade came down the stairs. The explosion shook the house yet again. Then came 2 sets of footsteps. The Russians were moving fast, and no doubt worried that members of this attacking force, whoever they were, knew where their principal was, and were heading there to abduct him. Marcus considered popping out and shooting them both from behind. That would make 10. But something held him back. 84. For a few seconds, it was silent. Then Marcus heard the distinctive sound of pins being pulled on not one, but 4 more grenades. 2 went rolling down the hall away from his location toward the other wing of the mansion. 2 came his way. Before he could hit the deck, the successive explosions sent him hurtling through the air past the pool table and crashing against the wall on the far side. The air grew thick with clouds of smoke and the fine dust of crushed sheetrock. The floor was littered with shards of lumber, twisted metal, mangled light fixtures, and shattered glass. The ceiling had become a mess of scorched beams, melted HVAC ducts, and dangling wires. Marcus had no idea where his rifle had fallen. It was somewhere in all this debris. He dropped it the moment he went airborne, but he couldn't search for it yet. Nor could he check to see if anything on him was broken or bleeding. He didn't have the luxury. He knew for certain these guys were coming for him. He'd be coming for them if the situation were reversed. If he made a sound, he would give away his position and make himself a target. But just because he was a sitting duck didn't mean he couldn't defend himself. Slowly, he reached with his right hand for his pistol, drew it from its holster, raised it, and aimed it at what had been a door and was now a gaping hole in the wall. His ears were ringing even worse now. There was no way he was going to be able to hear someone coming around the corner. At least with his night vision goggles, he'd be able to see them coming before they saw him. Then the goggles shorted out. With his left hand, he pulled them off and set them aside. As his eyes readjusted to the darkness, his mind tried to comprehend the new reality that he was no longer the hunter, but the hunted. He flexed his fingers. They were working. He wriggled his toes. They, too, were working. He turned his head from side to side, still never taking his eyes off the hole in the wall. His neck was in immense pain, but at least he hadn't broken it. As quietly as possible, he bent his right knee. He tried to bend his left knee, but a jolt of searing pain shot up his spinal cord. He pulled off a glove and dabbed the knee with his left hand. It was bleeding. No matter, he had to get up. He had to make sure his back was not broken. He had to get moving. 4 of the Russian bodyguards were still alive, Surely one of them had called for backup by now. Where would the reinforcements be coming from? How long would it take them to get there? How many would there be? He had no answers. But if he wanted to live, if he was going to complete this mission and get Alec and his files out of here, he had to get on his feet. His hearing was slowly coming back. Both eardrums might prove permanently damaged. Only time would tell. But at least he could hear something. And just then, he heard the crunch of glass and wood in the hallway. Someone was coming. Without the night vision equipment, the basement was pitch black. He'd expected his eyes to adjust after a few moments, but there was nothing to adjust to. So Marcus actually closed his eyes and listened. There were two of them, moving cautiously, surely as blind and maybe as deaf as he was. Marcus could see the men in his mind's eye, standing in the hallway, now directly in front of him. He pulled the trigger. 6 shots in 2 seconds, left to right. He heard both men collapse to the floor. His eyes still closed, Marcus ejected the spent magazine and popped in a full one. Then, slowly, painfully, he forced himself to his feet. Jenny Morris was covered in a blanket of snow, and it was coming down harder. She was less worried about getting frostbite and losing a digit or two than losing her ability to react quickly when the moment arose. Her eyelashes were nearly frozen. Her fingers weren't numb, but they were heading in that direction. She had no idea what was going on inside the house. Only the repeated bursts of gunfire and occasional explosions and flashes of orange light gave evidence that the fight was still on. That was a good sign. If someone was still shooting, hopefully, Marcus was still alive. Another fear haunted her, however. She hadn't seen the agent in the back of the house in a while. What if he had been alerted by his colleagues to a sniper in the woods? Could he have been ordered to outflank her and take her out from behind? She forced herself to resist the temptation to keep checking behind her. Marcus had left her with one simple order before going into the house. No one could get back to the SUVs alive. She'd already fired at the tires of the SUV in the rear and flattened them all. Since then, she'd maintained her focus on the 4-yard gap between the front door of the Kroskin home and the closed doors of the SUVs. The moment the front door opened, she'd have only a split second to open fire. She didn't necessarily need to hit or kill anyone. She did have to keep them from successfully getting into the vehicles and leaving the premises. Morris was determined to do her job, no matter how cold she was, regardless of how long she had to wait. Her second radio crackled to life. Not the one that connected her to Marcus, but her link to the Global Operations Center in Langley. They wanted an update. She had little to tell them. No, she had not heard from Razor. No, she could not confirm the Raven was alive. No, the package was not yet in their possession. No, she was not aware that the agents on site had called for backup. This last fact was a very serious development. Langley informed her that 3 choppers were spooling up on helipads behind Lubyanka. Heavily armed commandos were loading in. They would be airborne in less than 2 minutes and would arrive at her location in no more than 15. Copy that, she replied. Before she decided whether to relay that critical last piece to Marcus, the front door burst open. She fired. No one came out the door. But now she had exposed her position. A sniper began firing back from, of all places, the little window in the attic. Frozen stiff, yet coursing with adrenaline, Morris rolled right, down a slight embankment, taking herself out of the shooter's direct line of sight. She doubted the guy had night vision goggles. None of the others did. He was just firing at her muzzle flash. She continued rolling right until she could again see the window, the gun barrel poking through and a shadow behind it. With her left hand, she pulled the keys to the Mercedes from her pocket. It was still about 20 yards farther to her right, and clicked the lights on. The instant the sniper saw the lights, he began firing in that direction. Morris cut the lights again, looked through the reticle of her scope, took a deep breath, and pulled the trigger twice. She saw the man's head jerk back violently and then disappear from view. In those brief seconds, however, someone had gotten to the lead SUV. The engine roared to life. The headlights burst on. Jenny Morris opened fire with everything she had, but the vehicle took off into the night, and she had no idea who was inside. 85. Marcus heard the words, but couldn't believe them. He'd given Morris one job, and she'd blown it. Not only had she allowed one of the SUVs to escape, she wasn't even sure who had driven it, an agent or Alec. If it was an agent, that was bad enough. But if they'd lost Alec and the files, then the situation was catastrophic, for reasons only Marcus could fully understand. The possibility that there was still an ex-Spetsnaz soldier on the loose in this house seriously slowed Marcus's approach to the panic room. Worse, Morris had radioed him that helicopters filled with more men were heading their way. Marcus pulled out his phone and turned on the flashlight app. He searched the floor of the billiard room for his rifle, and when he found it, he looked at his knee and saw blood dripping. He grimaced, but put the injury out of his mind and turned his attention to the hallway. He'd heard no sounds, no movement whatsoever on the bottom level since he'd taken out the last guy. If someone was waiting in the shadows to pop him, so be it, he thought. He knew where he was going when he drew his last breath on this planet. Moving as quickly as he could with a limp and in wicked pain, Marcus climbed over debris and the dead and finally made it to the panic room. He shone the flashlight up one hallway and down another, but saw no one and heard nothing. So he entered the code into the touchpad. Nothing happened at first. Then the panic room's independent power source kicked in, and the massive steel door slid open. Alec Kroskin sat on a wooden stool, looking fairly calm given the circumstances. Marcus lowered his weapon and pulled off his balaclava.
"Took you long enough," Alec said.
"Sorry, hit some traffic," Marcus replied. "You okay?"
"I'll live. A little while longer, anyway,"
the Russian deadpanned. Marcus took the gallows humor as a good sign. "Got something for me?" Marcus asked.
"Absolutely,"
Alec said, producing the thumb drive.
"And you?"
"Absolutely," Marcus said, reloading the pistol and handing it over. He showed the Russian exactly how the silencing mechanism worked, where the safety was, and how close he would need to be to Luganov to maintain accuracy. "Anything under 5 feet, you should be good. The closer, the better, especially if you're behind him and he's not looking. But if you're facing him, then don't get too close, or he could bat it away before you pull the trigger."
"Got it," Alec said. "Is the plane ready?"
"It will be by the time you get there."
"And my ride, is it on the way?"
"Just lifted off from Lubyanka. ETA 12 minutes. Alec smiled grimly as he pulled a package of cigarettes and a lighter from his jacket pocket. He lit one and took a long drag. He closed his eyes and seemed to savor the taste and the moment. "Before we forget, I need the passwords to get into all your files," Marcus said. Alec reopened his eyes. He reached into another pocket, retrieved a folded piece of paper, and handed it over. Marcus opened it and found it was a computer printout of at least 20 different passcodes. He took out his mobile phone, snapped several pictures of it, then borrowed Alec's lighter and set it aflame. Suddenly, Morris's voice crackled over the radio.
"Keyhole to Razor. The choppers will be here in 9 minutes. Over."
"Roger that," Marcus replied. "Get the car in position and stand by." He turned back to Alec. "Since we have a moment, can I ask you a question?"
"Of course," Alec said.
"You told me that Nemkov wants to proceed with the invasion, but Petrovsky does not. Did I get that right?"
"You did."
"So if you succeed tonight, and the president is out of the picture, do the war plans go forward without the full and active support of the defense minister?"
"Probably not."
"Are there others in the cabinet or in the war council pushing for war?"
Others who really want to attack NATO?
No, I don't think so.
Just your father-in-law.
And Nemkov.
Right, Marcus said. And if the president is gone, and Nemkov is alone, could he persuade the others to proceed?
I don't know. I don't think so. No.
What will Petrovsky do? Alek considered that for a moment.
I think there's a real possibility he will arrest Nemkov for treason and call off the war.
Could he do that?
I believe so. The last public statement made by the president to Senator Dayton and the world was that he was going to pull all Russian forces back from the borders and de-escalate the situation. Petrovsky could proceed on that basis, while accusing Nemkov of trying to orchestrate a coup against Luganov. He could throw Nemkov in prison and announce that he was carrying out the express wishes of the late President Luganov. It just might work.
Ain't it better, Marcus thought. Again, Morris radioed in.
7 minutes.
Marcus ignored her. So you remain convinced it all comes down to whether Luganov lives or dies?
Believe me, Mr. Riker. I want there to be another way,
Alex said.
But I can't come up with one. Can you?
No, I can't, Marcus said. And I'm sorry.
Then may I ask you a question?
Alex said. Of course.
If you were in my place, if the situation were completely reversed, would you do it?
Marcus paused. He hadn't thought about it in those terms. It doesn't really matter what I do, Alec, he finally said. It's your life. Trust me, I won't judge you for a moment if you choose not to do this. You can leave with us right now, and we'll get you out of the country if you want. It's your choice. Alec looked thoughtful.
I keep thinking about what Solzhenitsyn wrote in the Gulag Archipelago. In keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age. We are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. My father-in-law is attempting to perpetrate a terrible evil. I can't just save myself. That's the coward's way out, and I've been a coward for too long. I want to do something significant, something important with my life. I wouldn't have chosen this. I'd much rather have retired to the Riviera and tried my hand at writing a great Russian novel. But these are the cards I've been dealt. This is the hand I need to play.
And your wife and son? Marcus asked, wondering why he'd never once brought them up. Don't you want to be with them? Alec looked down at the smoldering cigarette in his hands.
Whom do you think I'm doing this for, Mr. Riker? I may never see them again, but at least they won't be vaporized in a millisecond of brilliant light.
Again, the radio crackled. The choppers would be there in less than 4 minutes. They were out of time. 86. Go, 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 Marcus yelled as he bolted out of the house and into the Mercedes.
Where's Kroskin?
Morris asked, visibly stunned to see her partner alone.
Never mind, floor it, Jenny,
Marcus ordered. The CIA's top operative in Russia bristled, but with the choppers inbound, she did as she was told. Marcus reloaded his rifle and prayed for his crazy scheme to work as they blew through the front gates and tore down the slick back roads at dangerously high speeds. It was still pitch black. The clock on the dashboard said it was only 4:28. Few other cars were on the roads at such an hour. But the snow was coming down even harder now, and Morris had the windshield wipers on full blast. As blood continued oozing down his left leg, Marcus reached into the back seat, grabbed his backpack, and pulled out his first aid kit. I have the flash drive,
he said at last, as he fished through the kit, until he found a hypodermic needle, loaded it with a painkiller, and jammed it into his left thigh.